Britain seems awash with complex challenges. My guest today is Maura Wallace, who has looked very carefully at these complex challenges and spent some of her career tackling them. So Maura, very nice to have you here. Now, I know a lot of listeners will know you, but some won't. So you have a long career in the civil service, and pertinent to our question today, which is about how to tackle complex challenges, you set up and led something called the Social Exclusion Unit in the Cabinet Office, which was a cross-departmental unit to try and tackle a very complex issue. And I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about that and what your experiences were there before we get on to impact.
This is a job that the incoming Labour government created quite soon into its time in 1997. And my history before then was that I had done 10 years as a fast streamer in the Treasury, and I was now a private secretary at number 10. The Social Exclusion Unit was set up to look at what Blair called joined-up problems that he thought might require joined-up solutions. And it was cross-departmental. He sponsored it directly. It worked to him. And it worked on a project basis. At launch, we were given three issues to look into. So how would you reduce the level of school exclusions? How would you reduce the level of school absence? How would you reduce the level of rough sleeping? So they were quite quantitative. Assumption, this is a bad thing. Costs for individuals, costs for the state. How would you reduce it? And I had a small team from across several different departments, from local authorities, the police, probation, voluntary sector, private sector, very, very mixed team, which was key to the approach. And we were encouraged to work in a very open way. And we were given timetables, so which we didn't always make, but we did try. I worked in that unit for, I think, nearly 5 years, and we tackled a succession of issues. But there were some real common themes between them. A lot of the common themes were about young people, which I've sort of carried with me as an interest and an expertise ever since. But the Social Exclusion Unit was a real opportunity to do things differently and kind of change my life, but hopefully some other lives as well.
Yes, and we'll get on to look at some of these areas because it really did have impact. On the remit that you had, did you have to come up with some short-term solutions? To what extent was there direction to tackle the long term?
It was quite clear that here was a thing that was very undesirable. We knew what the current level was. There was a desire to reduce it. And in some areas, we produced targets for almost all of these. We were fans of targets. And in some, they were targets to be met in 3 years. But in others, famously, the teenage pregnancy strategy, which we wrote, we set a 10-year target because we thought it would take that long. And in fact, it took longer. And we took a very broad view of what was evidence, and we worked with departments who, you know, already had experience of these issues and were sometimes struggling with them. And so they would have data and they would have research, which they would share with us. We consulted incredibly widely with people at the front line, with academics saying, if you think you know something that's relevant to this, please tell us. Mm. And we formed good relationships with academics, notably the LSE, and they had under the late John Hills, Centre for the Analysis of Social Exclusion, who were excellent friends to us and had so much expertise we drew on. And there was a lot of what I call the go and look method. So there was a lot of us going to meet people who were affected by whatever it was we were discussing and just listening hard.
And how far did your synthesis of what was going on, because you could see quite a lot of dots and you were joining them, how far was that news inside government?
I think it was not completely unknown, but the extent of it was transformational. And I think that one of the things we were able to do was be really, I'm going to use this word again, quantitative. So, for example, rough sleepers. There are a number of well-known paths into rough sleeping and well-known complications. For example, many rough sleepers have a history in care or in the armed forces. And many have mental health problems and many have problems with drink or drugs. And these were known, and there were little grant schemes that were trying to deal with people who were, in the jargon of the time, dual diagnosis. But if you looked at the scale of that grant, it would have covered about three people. So you had to actually say, but that's not remotely enough. And if you want to solve rough sleeping, that number needs to be much bigger, or the same people will be cycling around the system with their problems not being addressed. We learned, though, how connected these issues were. So to take a different example, a couple of years into the unit, we were working on two projects at the same time, and one was teenage pregnancy and the other was NEETs. Yes, we knew when we chose those topics that there was a relationship, but the relationship was so much closer than perhaps we realised, in that both people who end up NEET and people who end up having children in their teens often have a whole set of risk factors of having grown up in poverty, having hated school or dropped out of it, a whole set of social issues that make it much more likely that they're going to end up in problems. And once you've had a child as a young person, it's really hard to get into education, employment or training, particularly if you were pretty disengaged before you started. So it's an example of how these things are connected. Huge risk factors for both of those. School absence, school exclusion. You know, these things are all connected.
So I can see how this work could give you much more 2020 vision on the diagnosis, the issues. Mm. You were then in a better position to think about targeted responses that I presume then the departments were tasked with, or that, is that how it worked?
Yes, the social exclusion unit existed to incubate the solution and to persuade people of it. We couldn't say, look, we've decided you've got to do it. So we had to persuade departments and go through all those cabinet approval procedures. But implementation was for departments. Very often it became apparent that there was actually just a structural gap in departments. There was no one in charge. Yeah. So, for example, rough sleeping, we said this is an intense problem that requires an intense on-the-ground focus and prevention and reintegration. And if you really want to crack this, you need to set up a unit that is going to just be absolutely determined about it. And we did set up such a unit and we appointed Louise Casey to run it.
Right.
And the rest, and is, the rest history. Is history. And the rest is history. Ditto on teenage pregnancy. You know, you can't leave this to be the accidental result of how good a whole set of other policies are. So we said, actually, this needs a sustained focus. And we set up a unit with some brilliant people in charge of it who ran that programme for a very long time, working with new staff roles that we created in every local authority in the country, teenage pregnancy coordinators, and that was your delivery network.
So I get the wiring right. You're diagnosing the problem and escaping the solutions more fully than done before, based on evidence. You then work with departments to mobilise and sometimes create units that would then tackle it at a national level. And then they would separately go and work at whatever level they needed to.
Yes. What is it you want to make happen? What are the obstacles? And how are you going to mobilise resources to change this and to gain the benefits of changing it? And although I've described a set of dedicated implementation arrangements, these were not buried deep in a department to be forgotten about. So they had cabinet ministers or ministers of state who were accountable for them. Very often they had a little implementation group of ministers with people like Alan Milburn and Tessa Jowell and so on, Hilary Armstrong on them, who, of course, were meeting each other in loads and loads of meetings trying to solve the same social problems that they had all come into politics to deal with. But this was the era of targets and it was the era of Treasury targets. And so I think almost without exception, the targets that emerged from social exclusion unit reports were woven into those departments' accountabilities and sometimes into several. And then they became part of this, you know, we must deliver, we must be accountable, we must be transparent machine, which was very visible, very impactful.
And you say quite rightly that was the era of targets and performance and accountability, but it was also the era of investment, or at least later on after 2002. And quite a lot today would say, well, you know, with 1.1% GDP growth, with far more constrained resources, we can't. What do you say to that? And actually, in your, when you were operating in the way you say, how much was new money involved and how much was just a reprioritization of existing?
Let's not dance around this. This was a time of significant expansion in a whole set of budgets. So if you go back and look at the increase in resources tackling child poverty, there were year-on-year real terms increases in school spending per pupil. Not only was there investment, but there was real targeting of it to deprived areas rather than away from them. That was important. But a lot of what happened was not so much about money as about redesign. There was always a lot of money going into contraception. Is that designed in a way that a 15-year-old who started to have sex would feel comfortable accessing those services? And if the answer is no, then you have a problem. If it's actually designed in a place or at a time that they simply can't get to, then you are cruising towards a lot of unprotected sex and therefore a lot of abortions or births. So design is key. Different example. At one stage, the government had a real push on trying to reduce adolescent drinking. And one of the radical ideas that was pursued was to enforce the law and actually just stop ignoring underage sales. And so a team was set up. By this stage, I was at the Home Office. Police and trading standards worked together at local level to identify businesses that were selling alcohol to underage people and to try and take away their licences. And having had that fight, all sorts of retailers thought, you know, supermarket cannot lose its alcohol licence, therefore we have to be absolutely sure we do not sell to anyone underage. So that is why, Jennifer, I'm sure you're constantly asked to prove that you were over 18. All that Challenge 21, 25 stuff, all the stuff about actually checking the age of people is a product of the decision to enforce the law. And it just made it harder for young people to drink.
So let's get on to your very interesting report, because Moira published, actually it was a couple of years ago now, wasn't it, through LSC, a magisterial analysis of 20 plus years, actually, of government policy on trying to reduce multiple disadvantage for the most disadvantaged young people. And you looked at it in two phases, didn't you? The first 11 years or so, and then the second 9 years. Can you just take us through that? Because I think it's very instructive in how we try and tackle some problems today. Yeah.
So what I did was I looked back at a set of government policies. What was the policy goal? What resources, legislation, whatever went into it? And what were the outcomes? And I did this across a range of issues of adolescent disadvantage that are all interlinked in the way we've been discussing. Child poverty, educational attainment, absence, exclusion, teenage pregnancy, drugs, alcohol, youth crime. If anyone familiar with these things will know that many of them are risk factors for each other. What I found, and the reason I stuck with it, was that having been involved in some of these things till about the middle of the 2000s, I didn't really know what had happened in all of these areas. And when I looked at what had actually happened to the outcomes, I was stunned. I was stunned at, for example, school exclusion had halved. Persistent school absence had halved. Teenage pregnancy was on the way to halving, and then it did, and then it went further. An extra fifth of the 70-year-old population was in education. Yeah, these are big, big changes. You know, I'd worked in the Treasury where you kind of celebrate 0.2 of a percent or something.
Certainly on the economy, you would, yes.
Yeah, these are huge changes. The report is full of graphs, so if anyone reads it, you'll see a lot of them just show a whole set of really bad things tumbling simultaneously. And then the story sort of started to change. So there were really, really big improvements in a set of different forms of adolescent disadvantage. And there was a reduction in inequalities as well in many of them, which was great and was what you would have wanted as a policymaker. And they, you know, didn't magically stop in 2010. They carried on for a few years, in some cases for longer in others. As the data came out, I realised a lot of the graphs were moving in the other direction. And so school exclusion from the mid, from 2012 or 2013, started to go up again. School absence started to creep up again. Drug use sort of plateaued and then started to go up again. The attainment gap started to widen. If you look at the big picture in the report, what you get is, first of all, there were two completely different approaches to youth policy. Labour sort of grabbed it, wanted to prevent everything, change everything, include everybody, was prepared to spend a lot of money and reorganise, rewire Whitehall local government to do it. Constantly inventing new things, many of which I invented, many invented by others. Setting targets, hands-on about performance, constant dialogue between the centre and local delivery about who's doing well, who's not, how can you learn from each other. And then a very different approach under the Coalition and Conservatives, saying this is all costing too much money, surely this should be more local, why would we have targets we can't guarantee to deliver, a lot of this should be parents' jobs. Very, very different philosophy, different priorities and all sorts of other issues that dominated political life, as we know. So two very, very different approaches to politics, and then two very different trends in outcomes. And definitely a stalling, and then in for many of these indicators, not all of them, it started to get worse. You know the health field. much better than I do, but it's a similar picture, I think. So what did I take from that? Well, first of all, in block capitals, I cannot prove that the government policies had this effect. And I don't think that that was the only thing that was affecting these outcomes, but I don't think it was irrelevant.
Truth is, nobody knows what... Nobody knows. It's not possible to tell, is it?
It's not possible to tell. And, it, you know, kind of almost wouldn't even be ethical to try because...
Can't have a randomised controlled trial.
Well, of course you can, but it means that it's going to take you an awful long time to do the thing that perhaps you might feel is necessary right now. I believe what I believe. Others can read it and think about it. I think that despite all the scepticism that government can ever achieve anything, or even the way people may feel about that government, I think some amazing things were achieved. And policy decisions were not the only component, but I think they were an important component. But what really struck me was the mutual reinforcement of these different strands. Which way do you think it would work? If a 15-year-old is not drinking a lot of alcohol every night, they might be attending school more and doing better in their exams. Or it might be the other way around. They're attending school more and doing better in their exams and thinking, maybe I want to be focused on that and not go out this week or not go out till the weekend. And yet, drugs and exclusion. If young people are less likely to have a drug problem or get treatment really quickly if they do, maybe that will stop them being excluded. Equally, if they are excluded, they've got a lot of time on their hands. They may fall into the wrong company. I often find myself saying this, the structure of reality does not match the structure of government.
Yes.
But government should do something about that.
So this is very interesting. So two phases, one phase where things get better and things can only get better, things did get better, and then another phase where they went off again.
Well, that's an oversimplification because not everything went the wrong direction. Some took a while and some, I'd argue, still haven't. A teenage pregnancy is a really interesting example because it just kept going and going and going down until 2020 and it has now gone up 2 years in a row, which I'm very sad about.
It's interesting. Then that's an international trend, isn't it, as I understand? Is that right?
Nope.
Oh, right.
Which bit?
The international trend of coming down.
Well, yes and no. So it was an international trend that we were unable to participate in the 1980s and 1990s. So if you look at the figures for teenage conceptions in the 70s, the UK looks very similar to the rest of Europe. And then they all declined, you know, improved further and the UK didn't. So reject the idea that just because something is happening in another country is going to happen here. And what happened with teenage pregnancy was we started to do the things that other countries had done and then we got on board the downward trend. Mm. Why it's gone up again more recently is an interesting question, which I'm writing about.
Just on the levers again, obviously the diagnosis was better. It sounds like the construction of implementation was better across government. Better links with the local government, and there were clear delivery targets. Everyone knew what they were meant to be doing. In terms of the heavy lifting, though, was it mainly local government that had to do this heavy lifting on delivery rather than central government? And therefore, the question there is, what were the levers then? What made local government motivated to do a lot of this stuff? Was it the political stripe of local government was different in those days? Was it the financial incentives? And has that changed now is the question.
I think that there were a number of areas that did an enormous amount of the heavy lifting.
Local authority areas?
No, I mean policy areas. Child poverty. Actually putting more money in the hands of families, whether they're out of work or in work. Hugely impactful. All the evidence would tell you it would be, and it was. And when you've got a lot of people wrestling with child poverty, their ability to do all the other things you'd like them to support their children and teenagers is reduced. Secondly, the changes in the school system. So much change, all of which was going to help vulnerable children and young people. So the push on literacy, the push on early years, well, that's before the school system, the push to raise performance, to reduce absence, changes to the curriculum to make it more interesting and more flexible, the education maintenance allowance to encourage low-income people to stay on in school. Those are huge levers. So child poverty and the school system. And then there were a few really cross-cutting programs that were basically available everywhere. Sure Start is the best known. Much less well known, Connections, which was the joined up personal advisor plus career service for 13 to 19 year olds.
Ah, which is in the air at the moment. A sort
It should be. It really should be. So who is trying to help teenagers who may or may not be connected with school, may or may not get much support at home, and who are going through those enormous transitions of adolescence, going on to education, deciding what you want to do and making a start, but may include all kinds of other problems, you know, mental health, housing, sexual health. And Connections was that one-stop shop that was focused on helping people stay on after 16 and not be neat, but it was dealing with so much else. And it was able to signpost people and say, actually, from what you tell me, I think you need to book you an appointment with so-and-so, I'll get you some time with so-and-so.
And was this national?
It was national. Mm. And it was run locally, but it wasn't actually run at the local authority level. It was run on slightly larger regions. I wanted to mention those because it's so easy, even when one knows everything is joined up, to go back to atomized solutions. Mm. And sort of say, oh, we must have something to prevent this here. We must have a completely different something to prevent that. It's all the same young people. Or rather, young people and their families and their schools could benefit from a bit of simplification where, in general, if I go in that door, someone will be able to help me with this sort of problem. And I think that's really important. So why did local authorities help? Well, I think they shared the goals in many cases, politically and in terms of their functions. There was a lot of pressure. Yeah. Remember that the government was not afraid to say, I do not think the education service in this borough of London is any good and I'm going to contract it out. So that they were breathing down local authorities' necks in some cases. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of publicity. We want no local authority to have a level of X that's greater than Y. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of pressures pushing that way. But let me look at it the other way. I was a governor of my local school in Haringey. And I saw that school change from being one that no one wanted to be in to being really, really good and absolutely just functioning really well. And the head teacher, the teachers in that school, the parents of the children in that school, they were not participating in something they thought the government was making them do. Right. They were changing the lives of their children.
Clearly, we've got multiple challenges in Britain these days. Probably some from a legacy of the last decade or so, some new, but many requiring multiple different policies to be operating and or to be designed and implemented, or at least step back, a proper diagnosis of what the issues are and what to do. First in line has got to be the million young people, 18 to 25, who are neat. But given all that you've said, what kind of lessons now would you be giving to government on how to tackle these? And also some of the wiring too, given your experience in social exclusion unit in the Cabinet Office and given the fact we now have a new, very active, as we understand, Cabinet Secretary who might be responsible for, quote, rewiring government.
Well, you've mentioned one word I think is really important, diagnosis. If you look back through the social exclusion unit reports, that a lot of them follow a very memorable structure. What is the problem? Why does it happen? Why does it matter? It's always worth asking yourself those questions. And a lot of policy proposals shoot off without actually asking themselves why it happens or understanding why it matters. And often, the more you understand why it matters, the more sort of welly you put into it. So diagnosis is absolutely key. And it's a dangerous step to skip. The second is about joining up. So I love this image of rewiring. No one has defined what it means, but I am thinking of it as actual wiring. At the moment, the way we approach a lot of these things is as if you fit out a new spare bedroom, you decide you want a bedside lamp, and you go to the National Grid and say, could you run me a new wire to this socket? That's not how we run our houses. We have electricity throughout our houses, and we can plug lots of different appliances into them because the infrastructure is there. I think there's some missing infrastructure in government. Notably, any centre of expertise on children and young people. It is a bit of a homeless issue, fragmented across government. Now, Labour changed that. That was sort of undone again. But there's no one home where it's all brought together, where people can actually spot the synergies, the contradictions. If I've got 4 million and you've got 4 million and we're going to go to many of the same areas, could this turn into one programme that would be simpler for the local area? So join it up more. And I would say think about prevention more. It's really interesting. NEET is very important. But if you want to think about what the roots of the NEET problem are, you will not start at 16. You will look back in time and you will notice that in no way is this a situation where everything's going fine until 16 and then somehow or other it all goes wrong. And you will discover that lots of the things you would hope existed in schools to help people make that transition confidently, they aren't there, or they're happening at the wrong time when people can't focus. And then you'd think, are the children even there to receive it? So here is my statistic for you, Jennifer. In years 10 and 11, so the GCSE years where people are about, we hope, to not become neat, low-income girls on free school meals in years 10 and 11, almost half of them are persistent absentees.
My goodness.
Well, it's 23, 24, latest figures we've got. That's where you want to start. And that's the people who are actually on a school roll, but not there. Never mind the people who aren't. So I'm not saying that's the whole of the problem, but trace back. We're tremendously shocked that they have mental health problems at 17. Did they perhaps have them at 14 and have been on a waiting list all this time? Or was there perhaps something in their experience that's making their mental health problems worse? Actually look at the reasons why people have become neat, as well as looking at how they're going to know about opportunities and how they're going to adjust to a labour market that's changing very fast. And then come back to the question, who's actually in charge of helping a 17-year-old not be neat? And you will look in vain. You will look in vain. You'll find local authorities have a responsibility, but they've not got a lot of money and they've not had a lot of help to do it. You will discover that lots of people have gone to college but are not attending, and no one is telling anybody that they're not attending. So
this requires probably a relook at putting the picture together first. Yes. But as you were saying earlier, this is ideally done in a central spot.
Yes, or in a really coordinated way. Sometimes it just isn't going to be as simple as you'd like. Sometimes actually a big number that's far too high for a bad thing is going to yield to lots of little things. And you may say, oh, but, you know, how could teenage pregnancy be behind neat numbers? Well, it won't be behind them all. It'll be behind some of them. Or are you saying that people don't know about apprenticeships? Yes. For some, yes. Or are you telling me that it's all because there isn't a bus service to get from where this young person is to where the opportunity is? Well, sometimes, yes. And you want to solve it, you've got to solve the components. That sounds probably very demanding and shrill and easy for me to say now I'm not in charge of it, but actually it can be done.
So we must leave it there. Thank you so much to Moria for those insights. Let's hope that some of the learning from the 20 years that we discussed can filter its way into government to think about how to tackle some of these long-term issues. Please join us next month for more analysis on hot topics and long-term topics. But meantime, thanks as ever to Sean and Leo at the Health Foundation, to Paddy and his team at Malt Productions, and it's goodbye from me, Jennifer Dixon.